This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
We mustn't forget that the Lower Thames Crossing had the biggest single response to any transport public consultation in British history. And people overwhelmingly said, get on with it. And now we're going back and consulting again. And I think my message, as I say, to transport ministers and housing ministers, anybody, is you absolutely need it. You absolutely need it. And vehicles are getting cleaner and greener. Road design is getting better. Environmental mitigations are getting better. So, you know, this is an opportunity to build a fantastic piece of infrastructure. And we just need to get on with it.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week where there are concerns about Canterbury's local plan and housing, a fight over a village green near Allington, and political heavyweight Yvette Cooper stopped by in Medway to drill some holes. I'm Robert Boddy, local democracy reporter covering Medway Council, and I'm joined by Daniel Essen, who reports on borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And news editor Sean Delaney, who's standing in for KCC reporter and regular podcast host Simon Finlay, who's away this week.
Hello.
We'll also be speaking to KM political editor Paul Francis about the week in Westminster, and our special guest this week is Dartford council leader Jeremy Kite, one of the more colourful characters in local government in Kent. First up is Dan. What's been happening?
So I've yet again had my nose in the local planning process in Canterbury, but this time I've been speaking to villagers about the plans for 2,000 new homes north of the University of Kent.
So which villages are we talking about, and how might they be affected by these plans?
So there's quite a few villages north of Canterbury, but the relevant ones here are Tyler Hill, Rough Common and Blean. As part of Canterbury City Council's local plan, the University of Kent has put up a huge tract of its unused land north of the campus, which has now been earmarked as a site for 2,000 homes. And based on the maps that have been released, it pretty much looks like it's going to be in the middle of all three of those villages. Obviously, it's very early days and no planning application has gone in and probably won't for quite a while. But building an entire new village, you know, isn't an easy process. It will come with all sorts of havoc on the roads, and when people actually live there, it'll obviously put pressure on infrastructure and that sort of thing.
And what were the villagers saying about these proposals?
So I went to a meeting of Hackington Parish Council, which covers Tyler Hill and a few other hamlets in that sort of area. And the meeting was called pretty much mainly to discuss the proposals. It was very well attended, especially by local council standards, with about 60 or 70 members of the public and villagers attending. And as you might expect, pretty much nobody had anything good to say about the proposals. People were, you know, pretty worried, saying it would do lots of, you know, completely change the character of the area, that would do lots of environmental damage, and that the, you know, alleging that the villagers are being made to pay for the University of Kent's financial problems, because of course, you know, Uni of Kent will be selling this land to developers if it gets built on. Essentially, it was a lot of the arguments you hear all the time in local planning and house building process. You know, local infrastructure can't handle the strain, they don't trust the promises that new infrastructure and that sort of thing will come with the development.
So what are the villagers going to do about it, and is there much chance that the proposals could be changed?
So organised opposition is pretty much already mounting. There was one villager there who was collecting signatures for a mailing list, which has now been, you know, started as the Save the Blean campaign. All of the affected parish councils have been calling meetings on it and are telling residents how they can make their views known in Canterbury City Council's consultation, which lasts until the start of June. So I'd imagine until then there'll be a pretty concerted effort to get villagers to make their take on it known to the council. After this first round of consultation ends, in theory, Canterbury City Council can alter the proposals in the local plan in accordance with the feedback they've got. But in, you know, in practice, that's not very likely this time round. Canterbury Council has housing targets to hit over the next 15 years. That's exactly why local councils come up with these plans. And technically, these housing targets are advisory, but if you try to come up with a plan which doesn't meet them, you know, central government will impose them on you. So if Canterbury City Council were to wholesale scrap or in any way alter their plans for a new settlement of 2,000 homes north of the university, they'd have to find somewhere else to put those homes. And pretty much wherever they do that, you know, it's probably going to make somebody unhappy. So it's pretty unlikely the plans will change significantly.
Thanks very much, Dan. So, Sean, you've been tracking the goings-on at County Hall this week. What's caught your eye?
So, the long-awaited public inquiry has started into the campaign to get Bunyards Farm Village Green status. It got going on Tuesday and has been running all week at County Hall. Essentially, local residents and activists are resisting a proposed development for 435 houses on former farmland near Allington in Maidstone. Effectively, it's the last patch of green space as how house building encroaches from the Maidstone Borough side and from the Tunbridge and Morling Borough side. That is why the local people decided to take the landowners on and the developers on. They believe they can make the case for the site of about 45 acres to be given what is known as village green status.
What exactly is village green status?
Under the Commons Act 2006, if local people can prove the land has been in common use for 20 years and there are no signs prohibiting people from accessing it, it can get village green status. This essentially means that it cannot be built on or developed, basically, forever. In this particular case, the landowner stopped farming intensively at the end of the 1990s as a result of the mad cow disease crisis. The farmer also lost a contract whereby he no longer grazed cattle on the land.
So what happened at the inquiry?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about holes in fences. Sounds a bit of a joke, really, but in reality, much of this boils down to what the people did on the land and how they accessed it. There was a string of witnesses called to support the case for the applicants and for those who were objecting to it. But the objector called in a King's Council lawyer who indicated they had taken the issue very serious. The applicant said the fences had been down and used as access for decades, while the King's Council for the landowner claimed they were vandalised to create the gaps. The landowner's case also states that there were some agricultural activities, such as grass cutting for haymaking, during the period in question between 2001 and 2021, which meant it was still being used for farming purposes. The applicants claim the land is in common use for local people to enjoy for dog walking, flying kites and picking blackberries.
And what happens now?
Well, the hearing will be over this week and the independent inspector will then go away and come back with her recommendation in the next month or two, possibly even before the summer.
Thanks very much, Sean.
So, Robert, what news from the Medway towns?
Well, this week, Medway was visited by Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, who came to the Sunlight Centre in Gillingham to take a look at the various community schemes they've got going on there, including Men in Sheds, which is about combating loneliness and isolation. She talked with volunteers and people who'd benefited from the services at the Sunlight Centre, and even did a bit of woodwork, including drilling holes and a bit of sawing. It was also, handily, a good opportunity to promote Gillingham and Raynham's Labour candidate, Nishaba Khan, who's also Medway Council's portfolio holder for housing and property.
So what were the key talking points?
Well, she said that Medway needed to get its future back, and the only way to do that was, surprise, surprise, electing a Labour government. She said the endless internal conflict within the National Tory Party, with Rishi Sunak having to focus on keeping his job rather than running the country, was preventing places like Gillingham from growing and prospering.
So did she give any indication about how things might be different in Medway in particular with Labour MPs and a Labour national government?
Well, since Medway Council has had some financial problems, which we've covered recently, I asked if a Labour government would increase the revenue support grant, which is funding direct from the government, which the Labour group often talks about having been massively reduced in the past 14 years. She said a Labour government would look to put in place long-term plans to grow the economy and give councils a longer-term stability in their funding. From my conversations with councillors in Medway, one thing they'd really like is a multi-year financial settlement rather than a new one every single year, as is the current system. She also said Labour's focus would be to improve the situation around antisocial behaviour by getting neighbourhood police back on the beat and take action to cut waiting lists at Medway Maritime Hospital, which are obviously both things she said people had raised with her on the doorstep during her visit. Well, that wraps up everything that's been happening across Kent and Medway. Thanks, Dan and Sean, for your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dan will be hanging on to chat with our special guest, Jeremy Kite. Next up, we're speaking to Paul Francis, our political editor, about events at Westminster. What's the latest, Paul?
Well, if there's one thing guaranteed to cause palpitations amongst Kent MPs, it's the return of Operation Brock to our roads and the ensuing delays and impact on local businesses as the dreaded contraflow system is set out. You may ask, what's the problem? At least there's a strategy for coping with the ramifications of delays and disruption, and that's a fair point. But there is increasing disquiet among MPs that Brock has become the default position for the emergency authorities every time school holidays beckon.
So what have these MPs been saying, and is the government really listening?
Well, Faversham and Mid-Kent MP Helen Whateley has cast herself as the chief political inquisitor on this one, and she's not happy. Basically, she's arguing that the deployment of Operation Brock is not exactly a national emergency. It's to mitigate the impact of school holiday traffic. The question is whether the circumstances represent a crisis rather than an inconvenience, and Helen thinks it does not qualify as a crisis.
And while the election seems almost certain to happen in the autumn, you've been speaking to someone who already knows the results, apparently.
Well, a slight exaggeration of my attempt at a bad joke. But yes, I've been speaking to Sarah Hudson, the chairman of Kent Area Conservatives. She's basically the person who oversees and manages the party's 17 constituency associations. And she's told me that there's no prospect at all of the Conservatives winning and they're heading for a serious defeat. Now, that's a fairly brutal and candid assessment on her part. But she was insistent that this was the case and it was better that people knew where she stood. Now, whether she's right or not remains to be seen. There's still some time to go for the Conservatives to perhaps engineer a situation where they're not quite as badly organised or suffering possible defeats in a lot of seats. Of course, the Conservatives are setting their track record on the economy front and centre of the campaign, or will be, and Rishi Sunak at Prime Minister's Questions this week was very satisfied that he was able to say that at least one of his indicators was going in the right direction, even if it wasn't his own popularity. Now, there's always speculation about leaders when the government is sitting and the party is in control, and the Tories love nothing better than the chat about who might succeed the current leader. And one name that has come into the frame is Tom Tugendhat, the Tumbridge Morley MP, who stood last time around but made it through to the third round before having to drop out because he didn't get the votes. Now, he's been suggested as a possible unity candidate, which would bring together the One Nation Conservatives with the group that are more to the right.
As you say, there's been sort of a lot of chatter around about a possible leadership challenge. I mean, how realistic do you think these conversations actually are? Or is it just a lot of exactly that, a lot of talk?
I personally think that this is a lot of talk. The time is running out for the party to organise, hold, manage a selection process. There's no one immediately who springs to mind who would do a much better job than Rishi Sunak. So I think that they're going to stick by him for the till the election, and then there'll be an awful lot of bloodletting after the results.
The prediction from Sarah Hudson there is pretty dire. I mean, did she come up with any suggestions of how they might possibly be able to claw back?
Yes, and she said that it was, if there was a continuing improvement in the economy, they were able to cut tax rates and people were feeling slightly less pressured by rising energy prices and the cost of living crisis. That might help. But you do get the impression, talking to Conservatives, that they feel their time is up regardless of what they put in front of voters to digest.
And as you say, Rishi Sunak ruled out the May 2nd date for the election, and we've passed the date when it could be that date. Are you saying it's going to be later in the year? I mean, is there any possibility that sort of if the Rwanda policy gets off the ground, if the economy keeps going in the right direction as they've said it is, could we be looking at a summer election?
I personally don't think there'll be a summer election, but it's not outside the realms of possibility. My instinct is that they will wait until autumn time to hold an election, possibly around that half-term holiday period, which gives them a bit of time to frame a kind of a vision of the Conservative Party and fight on the economy, which is traditionally their strongest suit.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul, for your insight into what's been happening. See you next week.
See you next week.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
If week is a long time in politics and 18 years in local government must feel like a lifetime, that's how long our guest, Councillor Jeremy Kite, has been the Conservative leader of Dartford Borough Council. He joins me now in the studio. Jeremy, thanks very much for coming in.
Hi, Dan. You made me feel very, very old.
My apologies. So first up, by way of introduction, I guess I wanted to ask, how did you end up getting involved in politics and becoming the leader of Dartford Borough Council?
Ah, well, I have to be honest, I'm more Forrest Gump than planned back-of-the-envelope stuff. It's kind of been one thing after another. What triggered it initially was I woke up one Sunday morning and it was the days when you used to have genuine newspapers put through genuine letterboxes. And the Sunday Times had a photograph or a picture of the Channel Tunnel rail link route. And I thought, oh, that's exciting. Britain's modernising. We're going to get a Channel Tunnel rail link. And then I realised it went right through my house. So we all started campaigning in my little part of Kent. And people just said, oh, you're good at it. And it started at a parish level, really a local village level. And then an opportunity came up to join, I think, the district council first, actually, before the parish. But I love doing it. But as I say, there's been no master plan. And I don't have any further ambitions. I mean, that sounds a bit obvious, perhaps, but I don't have any further ambitions. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing, and it's been a great privilege.
So obviously, if I remember rightly, you became leader of Dartford Council in 2006. And Dartford's gone through quite a lot of change in that time. And one, the main one that comes to mind, not least because I get the train there quite a lot, is the Ebbsfleet Valley Development. I know you sit on the board of the Ebbsfleet Valley Development Corporation. I think that kicked off sort of mid-2010s time. What do you make of how that's progressed and how that's changing and going to change Dartford and the area around it?
Well, the big thing affecting Dartford is growth. I mean, you're quite right. Ebbsfleet is part of that. And my reckoning is that local people really don't want to see lots of growth, clearly. But the truth is our economy is growing. The South is growing. People need housing. If you're going to create a new community, you've got to make sure it's a good one. It's a big duty and a big responsibility. And it's also a privilege, actually, if you get it right. And the Ebbsfleet Development Corporation is interesting in that it really does seem to be building a whole community. And bear in mind, it was an old quarry. So there's nothing there in terms of history. Most of the places that people say that they desire to live in have got some history. You know, if I asked you where you wanted to live, you'd say somewhere really nice where it's been there, a medieval town or medieval village or something. This is a quarry where nothing is more than 10 years old. But what they've done is really interesting. They've created a community where it's a really cool place. There's a big diversity of people living there, a mix of families and elderly. It is a genuine mixed community. And they seem to be, there's a very positive vibe about the place. You know, lots of people working from home there, higher proportion than I've known. The landscape is very good. So I think if you're going to do it, it has its faults. Of course it does. I mean, there are parts of it where you simply can't achieve community status that quickly and you've got to work at it. But it's, I think it's nearly there and it's a good place. But my job, of course, is to make sure that growth doesn't overwhelm local people and make sure we get all the other things that go with it, the hospitals and the police and all the infrastructure that's needed. People are very quick to tell me when we fail to do that.
Yeah, I know the ones, obviously, it comes up all the time in planning and house building. You know, where does the infrastructure come from? Another major project, which is at Long Vex, the north of Kent and the sort of Thames Great Way area, is, of course, the Lower Thames Crossing, initially proposed well over 10 years ago, and now it's set to be probably one of the most expensive infrastructure projects in British history. Why do you think it's taken so long, and what's you and Dartford Borough Council's position on Lower Thames Crossing?
I don't know why it's taken so long. I mean, get on with it. I mean, the Victorians would have been this would have been a no-brainer. At any point in British history, when you have a rising demand and you can see it a mile off, and let's be honest, the demand for a new crossing was emerging in the 70s and the 80s. They could see where it was going, and there was simply no plan to do anything, and that was where the mistakes were made. And I just wish they'd get on with it. And our position is 100% we need it. I mean, Dartford's in a very unique position in that most towns next to a big strategic motorway have a bit of distance between them, a mile. I mean, I go to watch Dartford Football Club a lot, so I travel to lots of towns. And you'll go around the motorway and then you'll go off for 10 minutes and you'll get to a town. Dartford doesn't have that buffer. Dartford sits right on top of the M25 motorway. In fact, we're bisected by it. So our town is split in two by the M25. So when there is a problem, congestion, accident or whatever, protest on the M25, Dartford suffers. And it's simply not civilised. And so you'll find no stronger advocate than me for getting on with it. I do understand why people are nervous of having a new crossing near them. They fear all the problems that Dartford has will move to their area. I think the location, however, that's proposed is genius. It's actually away from Gravesham. It's in an area where population is light. Of course, there'll be effects on people, but they also have the benefit of having a great design now. They can build a brand new crossing with all the mitigations that Dartford can only dream of in terms of environmental benefits and replanting and getting everything right. So my message to my own government, my own colleagues, is for heaven's sake, just get this underway. Let's start, because then we can start to see the benefits of having a really grown-up bit of infrastructure.
Yeah, it's a topic that's been in the news a lot more recently. Do you think the stringency and nature of British planning law is a big part of that, and why it's taken so long?
Well, somebody I was speaking to reminded me that there is a project, I think, in Scandinavia where the project itself is similar in scale to this, and it has cost less than the planning, estimated planning costs of the Lower Thames Crossing. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't fact check these things, but that was the sort of anecdotal, and there's bound to be a grain of truth in it, that somehow we managed to trip ourselves up with endless consultation. Of course, public opinion is correct, is important, and we mustn't forget that the Lower Thames Crossing had the biggest single response to any transport public consultation in British history. And people overwhelmingly said, get on with it. And now we're going back and consulting again. And I think my message, as I say, to transport ministers, housing ministers, anybody, is you absolutely need it. You absolutely need it. And vehicles are getting cleaner and greener. Road design is getting better. Environmental mitigations are getting better. So, you know, this is an opportunity to build a fantastic piece of infrastructure. And we just need to get on with it.
So on the topic of projects which are taking quite a lot of time, obviously Galley Hill Road in Swanscombe has been closed for the better part of a year now after a landslide last April. Do you think that's for reasons quite specific to, you know, the site at Galley Hill itself, or do you think, you know, that is also a result of what you might call the intrinsic problems of British infrastructure?
If I'm brutally honest, it does come down to a very, very unusual occurrence, and I don't think there's been much dragging of heels on it. I mean, Dartford isn't actually any party to this. I mean, it's a map between KCC, the water company, government, highways. So we kind of oversee it. We've got a watching brief on behalf of the community, of course. But the truth is, it is such an unprecedented event, and it is such a large-scale solution. The day it happened, or the evening it happened, I remember looking at it, and I went on Google Earth to find out exactly where it was and to orientate myself. And I must be honest, I was surprised that the spine road was quite as thin as it was. And I'm sure lots of other people, when they look at it, realise now that that chalk spine is incredibly thin. I won't say that collapse was inevitable, but it does seem that once it's happened, we have to learn the lessons. What was interesting is that about half a mile up the road, Dartford does own a bit of land, very similar situation. We spent £5 million putting it up, shoring it up, making it safe for people at Waterstone Park. It's not a very sexy project. Nobody sort of thanks you for it, but it's the kind of investment that was needed, frankly, to maintain it. We are where we are, and I think this is going to be a very long solution. I must be honest. I mean, I'm an outsider. I'm not directly involved in it, but my belief is I can't see a simple solution to this. And I think if it were me, and I'm not technically expertise in this, I have no technical expertise, but if it were me, I'd be looking at an alternative route, I think, rather than trying to look at how that can be repaired. But as I say, please don't think that's a horse's mouth comment. It isn't. It's a very uninformed one, from my opinion, but it's a very, very big project to put right.
Obviously, another big deal that's gotten a lot of tension in Dartford over the past few months is the Orchard Theatre, which was closed after the fact that it had rack in the ceiling came to light. Obviously, the theatre's a very big deal in Dartford. So, yeah, we saw that, I think it was just today or a couple of days ago, a planning application has gone in for quite a lot of work, basically replacing the rack and sorting it out. You know, what's it been like working towards a remedy for that? And do you have any idea how long it might take?
The day that they told me that the roof was not secure, based on the new regulations that came in when rack start broke out, which I think must have been August of last year, something like that, was probably one of the worst days I've had, because the Orchard Theatre is so intrinsic and so vital to local people and so much love that we knew immediately, the first thing we said was, well, we can't let it close. This isn't going to be the end of it. It's not closing on my watch. And we knew we'd have to do the repairs. The second thing, which you haven't quite mentioned, Dan, is that we obviously decided to put something interim in its place. And that's not been without controversy because, you know, it's a lot of money to spend on a year's worth of temporary theatre. But the truth is we've spent around £2 million on it, and depending on how you measure it. But the thing contributes nearly £5 million in terms of local revenue and local economy. So on the day we were told that the theatre had to shut, I went to see a couple of restaurants and pubs right opposite, and they were bereft. And they said, look, this is going to be the final straw for us. So building the temporary one has enabled us to reassure those businesses and get that economy rolling again. And I think they're very grateful. And also artistically, we've managed to maintain the jobs of people at the Orchard. We've managed to maintain the programme. We've kept people entertained, put the panto on. And in terms of where the work is, it's right opposite my window at the office. So I see it every day. The scaffolding's up. They're up there every day working. And we're heading towards an August or September reopening. I'll probably get my knuckles wrapped for putting a month on it. But we're aiming for August or September, certainly to have it open by the panto.
OK, good to hear it. So I wanted to move on to more sort of national political stuff now. and obviously something that nobody can really avoid. There seems to be a bit of a growing consensus among the media and political class that your party, the Conservatives, are basically cruising for a bruising in the next general election. Do you think there's any way that the Conservative Party nationally might be able to pull off a historic fifth election win?
Yes, I do. I do think it's a possibility. However, I think what we're seeing here is a reflection of all parties losing their way, actually. And as I say, if there's any lesson from Dartford, and we're a very small authority, I don't make any claims about scaling up of what we do in Dartford into a national scene. But the thing we do in Dartford is we show a lot of common sense. We listen to residents. We have a conversational relationship with them. Politicians aren't here just to run politics. They are here to run a community on behalf of people. And I think the government has lost its way generally. I mean, I don't just mean this government, but I think it started to become almost an end in itself, that a government was just a being. It was there. And in fact, it's lost its whole raison d'etre, which is to make people's lives better. And I think that started with the end of Blair and the Brown years. I think the Blair media issues, the handling of the media, started that kind of cynicism about politics. It carried on. We're in a situation now where I think, if I'm honest with you, and a bit controversially perhaps, I think civil servants probably have too much say. I think society has moved to a risk-averse kind of situation now, where politicians are advised all the time not to take risks, not to be brave, not to have the courage, because it's safer to do the other thing. And I think in doing so, we've all walked away from residents and the people of this country. And I think I don't sense that, frankly, Keir Starmer has much to offer. I think what Keir's tried to do, as I see it, is to try to not do anything bad to the election. Well, that's not the way it should be. There should be bravery. And so when you see things like the 28 million quid on green policies and then, you know, being trumpeted so big and then dropped, I think what we're seeing again is no real passion for any particular politics. I think if you knocked on people's doors and asked about politicians, they would say a plague on all their houses. And all I can really talk about is our local dimension, where we try and stay connected with people and try and stay common sense. And I think we need representation, which is representatives who are like the population. And I think we've gradually moved away from that to a professional political class on all sides. We have to wait and see what happens, but I certainly think there's a case. I mean, I think there's been a very bad communications issue with the Tories. I don't think they've communicated. I listened to the budget very carefully and actually thought, well, actually economically we seem to be in quite a good position. There seems to be a plan, but it shouldn't take a budget speech for me to hear that. There should be more communications telling people where we are. And the Labour Party, again, I think should be encouraged to come forward with their alternative plans rather than just hide for cover and hope it'll be enough to take victory.
Okay, I see. And I guess the last question I wanted to ask you, sort of linking up national and local things, so since 2018, 13 local councils around the country have declared effective bankruptcy through issuing Section 114 notices. That's more than had happened in decades upon decades previously to that. You know, and a lot of local government leaders around the country, people in the local government association, people of all political shades and all parties, are saying that, you know, your party in government, the Conservatives, have a lot to answer for that. They've cut local government spending power by 27% in real terms since 2010. Do you think that the Conservatives nationally are responsible for a lot of the crisis that we see in local government?
I think we've been through an extraordinarily difficult period, and people are very quick to forget COVID, the expense and disruption of COVID, the massive change in the way our economy's productivity worked, working from home, and that productivity issue is still not resolved yet. We don't know whether we are going to be as productive coming out of it as we went into it. The massive world economic decline and disruption, war with Ukraine, all those things have happened. And I think to an extent, well, those things would have impacted on any government of any complexion at any time. And so there's an element of that happening. And I'm not sure that Labour or any other government, frankly, would have made a bigger difference. But that's the way, them's the breaks, as Boris Johnson said. You know, I think sometimes you are just left holding a bad situation and then you have to do your very best to explain to people that's what's happened. But on the doorstep, you know, I don't sense quite as much excitement about a change of government, or I don't sense there's a punitive nature in voters. I don't think they necessarily want to blame the Tories. I just think they want their country to be successful. And I think anyone who can do that stands a chance of winning. So I don't think it's a done deal, the election. In terms of local councils, look, the lack of money seemed to me directly has come from the economic pressures following COVID, and the money simply isn't there. And what I would say about it...
But, I mean, cuts to local government funding started in 2010, long before the pandemic.
Well, yeah, but so did changes to the way we could operate. And council, the fact that councils can survive, narrative suggests that councils can survive. I think when you look at individual cases of problems like Thurrock and Birmingham, you see in there leadership issues. And I've deliberately picked those two. So I've got a Tory council and a Labour council because I actually, you know, I'm not as political as people perhaps assume I always am. And when you look at it, I think there are particular leadership issues there, particular decisions there, particular states of mind at play. And I think what we've got to do is get councils back to focusing on local people. And, you know, they can succeed. The other point, the final point I make really on it is that there's nothing compassionate about crashing a council. So when KCC, a Tory KCC, has to make really tough decisions, it's very easy to leap aboard and say, oh, it's disgusting, you're cutting this, disgusting, you're cutting that. What a dreadful decision. How appalling. Nasty Tories. The truth is, there's nothing compassionate about allowing the council to crash, because what we've seen in Labour Birmingham is exactly what happens when it does. 21% increase in council tax and everything shut down immediately. No consultation, no discussion, none of this campaigning opportunity that we have in Kent when we make a decision. Literally, it's gone. And so I think it's a very fragile area. I think KCC are doing the best job in a very difficult circumstances. And I think Labour at Kent are actually broadly supportive, to be fair. The budget, there was virtually a wafer-thin difference between the Labour budget and the Tory budget. Relationships at the County Hall are actually pretty good. They always suffer a bit going into an election. But, you know, I think that we are doing a good job in difficult circumstances. But as I say, I can only repeat, there's nothing compassionate or helpful or good for society if you allow your council to crash. And it's a very difficult job keeping them afloat.
Yeah, no doubt. And very seasoned insights from a local government veteran, Councillor Jeremy Kite. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we hope to welcome Dover District Council leader Kevin Mills. Don't forget to tune in to KMTV at 5 p.m. for their politics show. See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.